outrider, someone who rides in front of or alongside a procession as an escort, a lookout, a vanguard. The outrider is separate from, but in communication with, the mainstream, pushing the boundaries, exploring, and reporting back from the frontier. Welcome to the Outrider Podcast, an ongoing conversation from the fringes of the mainstream. Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fucking suffering, man.
Really? Why?
One compound word. Perimenopause.
Oh.
I am telling you, it is kind of a nightmare.
Is it a pain in the uterus?
Literally, yeah. Yeah. Actually, at this point, it's more like, no, it's partially pain in the uterus, but it's more like hot flashes. And yet, but you still have a weird period, though. But then also, like, it's like, wait, can you choose? Yeah. Also, I'm 50. Hey, body, I'm 50. Like, literally, just stop. Like, obviously, this is not happening. Just stop.
I am 52. Well, shortly 52.
But you don't still have your uterus, do you? Sorry.
Nope. I did not receive one in the womb 52 years ago. So I have been sadly without for...
No, you know what? It's not a bummer because it sucks at this point. It sucks to have uterus. I used to tell people, like, whenever it was my period and it was a hard one.
Right.
I'm like, so this is Penis Appreciation Day. So... normally having a body like this is great and it's fine and it's fine. But like today's Penis Appreciation Day. So like, just if you have one of those and not all of this, then just appreciate that. And most of the men that I talked to about that, they'd be taken aback by the Penis Appreciation Day. And then they'd be like, so every day is Penis Appreciation Day for me, but I get it. So. I'm like, I understand that. I would appreciate it every day. I'm like, rub it, talk to it, call it George, appreciate it.
I have found that rubbing it every day is problematic.
What? Why? Isn't that totally healthy?
Well, it can create a certain groove in the brain. And then when you're presented with something other than your hand, it doesn't know what to do.
Oh, a groove in your brain.
Right.
That's
if you listen to the Savage Lovecast, you know that men are particularly prone to carving a very unique groove in their brain, and they can develop a situation where there's only one way they can get off, and that's it. Right.
Wow.
And it can create problems when they're, you know, in the sack with women. Or other men, if that's their preference, or other people, if they have a preference for the non-binary.
Any other hand besides your own.
Any other orifice.
Any other orifice.
Any orifice besides the adjustable orifice of
the hand.
Well, this podcast took a hard turn to the left.
Flashlight? Oh, a hard turn to the left sounds.
I mean,
like
when we're supposed to be talking about,
know about.
We were supposed to be talking about books and
doesn't
and
yours take a hard turn to the left?
Form and function. Does what?
Doesn't yours take a hard turn to the left?
No.
Hey.
No.
Oh God, I didn't mean to bring it down like that. So what are you drinking?
It didn't go down. It didn't go down. It didn't go.
Oh, okay.
It didn't go up.
Right. It different orifice. So that's the title of this episode. Is different orifice.
Different
it's going to mean nothing as far as our actual topic of discussion. But
well, I don't know. I mean, your whole even though we're going to be talking about form and function, and we're looking at three short pieces for you, these are about popping into places, which seems relevant.
You know what?
Because oftentimes,
that's
penis
a little bit
pop
of a stretch.
Into places.
I'm gonna allow it. I'm gonna allow it. I do tend to allow.
I'm very good at making the obtuse connection
into a place. It's fine.
Oh, God. So what am I drinking? I am drinking something called Mad Scientist from Wichita Brewing Company. It's a cranberry and apple golden ale.
Yum.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I'm doing my basic upslope pale ale, IPA.
Right on.
And I was just at the pub across the street that has had weeks, cheers, weeks, I say weeks, of no rosé. And rosé is a summer drink that I do enjoy because I am a white woman. So for some reason, that
white
is
woman
my
of a
like,
certain age.
One of my only white woman of a certain age tastes that I actually have is like rosé. So they've been out of it for a while. So I've been doing other things like Sauvignon Blanc and they do have an excellent whiskey there, though, a bourbon that's from a Mile High spirits place that's down in like kind of downtown Rhino-ish area. And it's delicious. But I know I always like whiskey, but sometimes it just isn't appropriate and or doesn't like me. So,
yep. Whiskey is the one liquor I don't have in my bar here at home.
Oh, I thought you had Jameson.
It's gone, but I don't.
Did
I don't
drink
often.
I usually drink off it last time I was there.
No, maybe.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. I usually my whiskey doesn't get restocked until my sister shows up.
Gotcha.
But I've been thinking maybe I should go get some just for shits and giggles.
You have a really good bar.
I'm trying to keep it up and stocked. I'd like to get a bigger cabinet for it all, but.
Oh, it's good though. It's very cool. It's very like. It's very like I'm coming into 221B Baker Street and I'm going to tell you all about my weird experience with a strange person who wants to hire me on as a governess. And you're like, can I please offer you some refreshments as you told me your story? I'm like, please, Mr. Holmes, yes. I have no one else to turn to.
I might actually start keeping some white wine on hand more often because I did find a white, or at least one brand, one style of white that doesn't give me heartburn.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
That's nice.
It's a Pinot Grigio. Now,
Grigio is good.
It was a boxed Pinot Grigio. So I'm going to try around other types of, you know, bottled and different labels and all this other stuff. See if
experiment.
If be consistent because, you know, if I like
get
go
some
like
tons
with,
and experiment.
Other whites tend to give me heartburn at this point in my life.
Rosés give me heartburn. Everything fucking gives me heartburn. Again, with the being in our 50s. What the fuck? Anyway.
Yep.
Bodies are fucked up.
Being aged.
Being aged. With an exalted you.
I don't look aged. Neither do
you.
No,
you look good. No, we look good.
I just need to lose a little weight.
I keep being told that, and I'm kind of like, what part of that is actually true, and what part of that is just like American fucking culture? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand that. But the reason I need to lose weight is that once I get under 200 pounds and I start getting down to what I feel like I should be at, which is 180, the lower my cholesterol gets.
Right, right. No, that's true. That's true.
And that's something that my doctor and even my stupid, you know, employer-funded health insurance likes to pay attention to is my, you know, the circumference of the waist and all this other shit that...
BMI shit is so nonsense, though.
Right. So if I lose 20 pounds... then I don't get charged the fat bastard surcharge on my insurance. And I don't have those conversations with my doctor. Well, your cholesterol is a little high, but this is, this part of it is okay. And this part is okay. So let's put your data into the little, you know, calculator and find out whether or not you're in the group that will benefit from a statin. So far I've managed, even as I've gotten over 200 after again, I've managed to stay in the group that says, oh no, you don't have any of the other factors that show a,
well,
a statin
and statins, like statins fuck you up even more than their benefits, though, is my understanding about that.
But if I get below 200 pounds, my cholesterol gets
below
200.
No one's
even going
to talk about it. Yeah.
And if my cholesterol is below 200, nobody can say shit to me.
I'm sorry. What are you? 6'2"?
6'1".
6'1". 6'1".
I was close to 6'2" at one point in my life, but I'm shrinking because we are aging.
Because we're, again, aged. Yay, cheers.
No, a couple of years ago, I went to the doctor and the nurse tried to, you know, measure me. And I don't know what the fuck was wrong that day. Maybe they didn't have the thing on the right part of the wall or whatever. What? You know, they didn't have it set up right. Or I was just kind of like, slouching. But she gets done measuring me. She goes, oh, 5'11". And I went, 5'11"?
No.
Nobody loses 2 inches in a year, lady.
No.
Not unless you remove an entire vertebrae. Right?
Vertebra.
Vertebra. Nobody loses 2 inches.
Not if you take off your bra.
Nobody loses 2 inches. Maybe a quarter of an inch. Maybe an eighth of an inch.
You do, but not in 1 year.
Not in 1 year. No.
Yeah. No, nonsense.
So they measured me. I went into the doctor last week because I was having my shoulder looked at, which it turns out is just me being an old man throwing things.
Aging. Just aging.
Right. But the thing was, is that when I asked for the appointment,
wait,
I said,
throwing
fruit,
what,
vegetables,
things. Why are you throwing fruit?
I have in my backyard, I built this bin for like compost and yard waste and shit like that.
Oh, okay.
And so like if fruit goes bad or something in the kitchen, you know, I step out on the deck and be like, whoosh, because I always used to be, you know, whatever. I was a third baseman and a catcher when I was a kid playing sports. I was a quarterback playing football. I throw things. I like to throw things as much as I'd like to run. I like to run and throw things, which is which is why it's so fucking frustrating to me that I try to run and the plantar fasciitis kicks in and then my ankles get stiff and my heels hurt and all this stuff.
Yep.
And then I go out in the backyard and I think, okay, I can still throw accurately. And the next day it's like, wow, my shoulder hurts. And when I reach across my chest, something pops. So I went to the doctor to look at that. And of course, because I'm 50, I also have sciatica.
Yeah, of course.
Because I have a fucking sedentary desk job. Well, the thing is that if that sciatica gets bad enough, it can actually cause testicular pain. So when I asked for the appointment, I told my doctor, I said, I have problems with my shoulder and a testicle problem. And I got done sending that message. I thought, oh, they probably think the problem is I've been jerking off too hard. Well, stop jerking off so hard. It's like, that's not it. I threw things and then my back hurts and my nut hurts.
I threw things. I threw too many nuts. Wait. No, that's not it. An extremely long penis. And I've been jerking on it way too hard.
Way too hard. Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
So this is why I went out years and years ago and followed some old piece of wisdom, whatever, is that I found a doctor who is my age and male.
Ah, nice.
So we're growing old together, me and Dr. McCarty.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Right. So he kind of being you know, 52-year-old men now, you know, he knows what to look for because he's up on keeping up with his own health.
He's doing it.
And I just walk in and go, so what do we need to look out for next time? You know, and we can make jokes about shoulder pain and nut pain and back pain and whatever.
Pain. Cause
we're 52-year-old men.
He knows it. That's interesting. My doctor used to be an older woman than me, which is nice because then she could just be like, okay, so all this stuff. So when did your mom go through menopause? I'm like, okay, here's the thing. So my mom got all the block and tackle taken out at 42. So we had no idea when she would have gone through. She's like, oh, okay, well,
right.
Yeah. She's like, well, you might get your period till you're 54. I'm like, don't you fucking look me in the eye and tell me that. That is a mean, mean thing to say. Like, on the one hand, I'm really excited because I'm like, okay, good. Finally, I can be done with my period. I don't have to worry about it. Like, you know, it's, that's like, great. I'm ready to be like doing the next phase of my body. Like, let me come of this age, you know? Right.
Right.
So, but the same, this is like this kind of really fucked up in between kind of nonsense, which is nonsense. So.
Right, right, right.
Oh, yeah.
My mom was in her late 60s, maybe early 70s by now, when she had her hysterectomy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And my sister came down.
So she'd been in menopause for a few years then.
She'd been out of it. She'd been done with it.
Yeah, totally.
For a long time.
Yeah.
So, and Amber came down from Jersey when mom went in for that surgery and everything so that someone could stay with mom while I was at work and all this other stuff like this.
Cool.
But
yep.
This is the sense of humor that my family has. When mom came home from the hospital after the surgery, Amber and I invited friends over and we had a wake for her womb.
Okay. That's fantastic.
We actually asked the doctor, said we were like, can we take it home with this and bury it in the backyard with the cats? I mean,
it's like, no.
It's like, no, it's biological waste. It's hazardous. Has to go
no,
away.
No, you cannot.
But we were, we asked. We fucking asked. We had to make sure.
So, can you preserve it in a jar so that we can like have our party around it?
That's cool. The big joke was it was the only womb we ever shared.
Oh,
right. Room, womb, all the, you know.
Whatever. Okay. You know what? That's amazing. A womb of one's own.
A womb of one's own.
That's incredible. I love that.
But we had a wake for her.
I love that.
For her uterus.
Man, you know, I didn't really have a divorce party, but maybe I should have like a like an anti-fertile party. Like
you should definitely have a minnow party.
It's minnow party.
Definitely.
Invite only men or no?
No, it could be whoever you want. Because
whoever I want.
You are free of the shit.
Have a pause party. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. I should totally do that. I'm inspired. Oh my god. Anyway.
Right. We're talking about your pieces here today, so let's hear first what you are reading these days and what you're working on.
Right. What did I just finish? I just finished another nonfiction book and I don't have it in front of me because I'm an idiot and I'm not very well prepared. I took notes, but I didn't have to take notes about that. So I just finished another one. Oh yeah. Saving Capitalism. Capitalism for the Many, Not for the Few by Robert Reich. Good. It's good. It's interesting. It's very interesting. And then I've been reading a lot of Substacks and I'm about to embark on my Michel Foucault journey.
Oh.
Which is going to consist of, because it's like, you know, as a humanities professor and as someone who's gone through a lot of schooling in literature and the humanities and writing, I have a lot of like oblique experience with different thinkers and writers and all that kind of stuff. Like I have oblique experience with a lot of stuff. But actually reading the shit, like I actually haven't read a lot of the stuff. Like I know of it, I can discourse on it. Like, you know, I can enter the discourse and stuff, but I was like, fucking, I gotta be in this Foucault thing. I gotta know about this. So.
Right. Right. You haven't read the primary sources. You've read the people that are interpreting the primary sources and applying the primary sources to other things.
Exactly.
And so, you know, Lukács and Foucault and yada, 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 blah, blah, but you haven't,
fine for the most part, which, you know, normally that's fine. And if I'm not inspired,
you
then
can stack knowledge on top
of
knowledge. It's exponential. It's Fibonacci. It's shit.
You know? Yeah. It's Fibonacci. It's exponentials. It's Fibonacci and shit. But I suddenly was like, you know, I want to actually, cause I think I would actually be interested in his stuff. So I was like, okay, I'm going to start with because the stuff I'm more interested in is his views on, because of his, like, his lifestyle and everything, I'm like, okay, I want to read his sexuality book. But then Paul was like, hey, so here's the deal. If you want to read Foucault and you haven't read Foucault, here's what you should do. And so he set me up with this kind of like Foucault regime. And he just suggested it. He's like, you can do whatever you want, obviously.
He majored
like
in philosophy, fully, right?
No, he majored in econ and poli-sci.
Oh, okay, okay.
But somebody he's a philosopher. Like he's very into it. Like he's written a lot about philosophy and he reads a lot about philosophy. He reads a lot of Zizek and
he probably secretly wanted to major in philosophy, but you can't make a living with that.
Well, yeah, he chose money and thank God, because otherwise the fuck would I be doing right now? Anyway, different story. Speaking of personal essays, but so he suggested a Foucault regime, which I was excited about, and I am about to start it. First, there is a bio of Foucault, and I don't remember the author because it's on the stack outside in the living room, which is where I have the things I'm reading right now, but it's a biography of him. And so Paul's like, start there. That's where you're going to learn most about his work when you read this biography, because it's brilliant. Then read my notes on when I read Foucault. I have a few pages of notes, and he's an excellent writer. And so he has it like distilled. It's like, it's like this little like tulip glass of like distilled spirits of Foucault. Then read that. Then read the Foucault sexuality book. I was like, that sounds actually perfect, because it's starting from where I already am, which is a sort of oblique knowledge of the stuff, then go into someone who I trust their brain and like how their brain is, looking at his sort of summary, his like Cliff's notes basically, and then reading the actual like primary source. So I'm excited, and I'm starting it very soon.
I seem to have lost my Foucault.
Oh. I hate it when that happens.
Not on the shelf where I expected it to be, but
okay. I hate it when that happens. And plus, I'm teaching a creative writing or a fiction. It's specifically about short fiction, but it's a creative writing course. And so I'm reading a lot of my students' work and facilitating their shit.
Oh, cool.
So I'm uniquely right now, especially because of this particular class that I'm teaching, equipped to talk about craft, because that's what I've been doing.
Good. Good, because I feel like my ramblings last month weren't great.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I disagree. I had a good time.
Well, having a good time and being cogent are not.
No. I mean, listening to your ramblings. if your ramblings were not good ramblings, I would not have had a good time listening to them. You know me. And what am I writing? I'm writing Substack 3 times a week. I'm about to enter my memoir into the Bridgeport Prize, which is a prize in the UK.
Ooh, nice.
Again, I tried it once before, and we'll see if it's a new judge this time. So we'll see if I can do it again. And I've been shopping it out still. I sent it to a small press, but the small press owner/head is going through a major like personal crisis right now. Uh-huh. So I think that I may need to wait a little while longer before they're going to be able to get it back to me, but we'll see. I was in a show recently that was Firefly themed. Remember that sci-fi show?
Yeah. No.
It was a Firefly themed burlesque show. Oh, you love Firefly. You would
yes,
love
I do.
Firefly.
I do.
Oh, you do love it. Yeah. So anyway, this is a burlesque show that was all Firefly. I played Captain Mal.
I have the box set of the series.
Oh, well, yes, of course. All the seasons.
All the season.
Yeah, exactly.
And the movie.
I played Captain Mal, and I did a burlesque piece to I Drink Alone by George Thorogood. And the person who is the kitten is in a burlesque show, is the person who takes the dropped clothes off the stage. So the person who played the kitten was also playing Inara. And so it's perfect. So I would like, I drink alone. I'm like drinking Jack Daniels. And then she'd come on stage and be like, I'd get all like nervous and like start to take my clothes off and she left. And then she'd come on like in the middle of me stripping. And it was pretty great. And at the end, I ended it just like the episode Trash, where Mal's naked.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, good day. That went well. So it was kind of wonderful. So that was super fun. I'm doing another show tomorrow.
Oh, good.
These are two different groups because my group is not performing in July. We're performing again in August. So there we go. Anyway, you.
Because I've been struggling so much to find books that I want to read and then finish them.
Right.
Particularly by American writers. I've been specifically going out and chasing down short novels or novellas by foreign writers who are appearing in the States in translation.
Oh, cool.
So I have I've been building a stack of, right now I seem to be very focused on Japanese writers.
Cool.
So I just finished Weasels in the Attic by Hiroko Oyamada.
Cool.
That was...
These are novellas?
Yep. Because they're very, very
tiny. Are they literary fiction?
Tiny. Yep.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. Neat.
Born in Hiroshima in 1983, she won the Shinsho Prize for New Writers for The Factory, which was drawn from her experiences working as a temp at an automaker's subsidiary. Her following novel, The Hole, won the Akutagawa Prize. And so, and I've got another one of her books floating around that I'm ready to read. But right now I'm reading Miss Ice Sandwich by Meiko Kawakami.
Miss Ice Sandwich.
Yes. And Kawakami was born in Osaka in 76. She was a singer and songwriter before making her literary debut in 2006.
Oh, cool.
Her first novella, My Ego, My Teeth, and the World, was in 2007 and nominated for the same prize that Oyamada won, and won another prize for young emerging writers. Published a short novella, Breasts and Eggs, which was later expanded into a full novel that I've been that I haven't picked up yet, but it's on the shelf at Watermark, so I will soon. There's a couple of other books of hers that I want to read. But yeah, so that's kind of my thing right now, is I'm going through my short novels by Japanese women.
That sounds really cool. It sounds like they have kind of a sublime sort of thing that you are always sort of searching for. It seems
right.
Like.
Well, because the concept, narrative and plot is slightly different. They have a different concept in Japanese literature than we do in the States. A lot of times plot here in the States, in Western literature, is very action oriented. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep. Well, like we talked about that with the carrier bag theory that we were talking about. Yeah.
And Japanese fiction tends to be a lot more, what do you want to call it? Psychologically focused. It's about that psychological arc. So the plot is oftentimes centered around that emotional and psychological process of evolution. So it's oftentimes kind of harder to tell what the central conflict is, when the conflict could simply be, you know, the natural evolution of the psyche into maturity or away from maturity or into insanity and all that stuff like this. So that's what
internal. Yeah.
And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that, you know, Japan spent a lot of time very isolated from everything. And that also leads to a lot of the weirdness that you see in Japanese culture that filters over to the States.
Sure. No, it's cool. It's so ancient, and yet it's also cutting edge as far as bleeding edge as far as technology. So it's like they have this dual kind of nature, which is fascinating.
One of my earliest exposures to Japanese literature in translation actually came through the avenue of erotica with a little book called Almost Transparent Blue. And I can't remember the name of the author, but I was just, it was a very, very fascinating little book, Almost Transparent Blue.
Mm. Was it hentai?
No.
Sorry.
It was literary.
That was me being a crass American, being like, that's the only Japanese porn I know about.
So that's what I'm reading right now, because it does two that's things. Too One, cool. It gets me out of the American thinking around fiction. Also, it gives me something short that you know, I've been reading Miss I Sandwich in pieces, but I will finish it this week. And just the sense, like, it took me 3 days because I'm easily distracted now and I'm struggling to focus when I read. But once I got in the stride of reading, I was done with it.
That's great.
Getting into that habit of finishing a book, going from cover to cover, mm-hmm. and getting that sense of accomplishment down, I think that'll help mm-hmm. me get back into my normal rhythm of reading, and I can attack some of these bigger books that are...
I don't know. A lot of our brains are very, like, I don't know. They've been altered by the plague. I think that a lot of us are
and
really
social media
super changed.
And then the plague and whatever. And
like, maybe there's a new normal.
I don't believe that. I think just like after the 1918 pandemic, we'll drift back to, it'll vanish. It'll be erased.
Maybe.
Yeah. So that's what I've been reading. Been working on my new Crazy Unconscious Days project.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. That's great. That's awesome.
Plowing ahead with that one.
Good.
Can't really talk
about
that much.
So you're doing everything. It's good because, like, it sounds like you're not only intaking, but outputting fresh stuff. And I think that's so probably excellent for you.
I go through my phases.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's good to have fresh shit going on.
And I don't know if did I tell you about my great rejection letter?
You did. You told me. Did you talk about it on the podcast?
No, because it happened after the last episode.
Yeah, you shared it with me. It sounded like a great rejection. It sounded like the kind of rejection that, like, got me published for the first time.
I won't give any details, but I'm going to read the body of the email. Thank you for sharing this manuscript with us. And they're talking about my Poison Moon manuscript.
Poison Moon.
We really enjoyed this work, your use of language and intelligence. It made it very far in our vetting process, but we require unanimous agreement among our readers to move forward with publication. Unfortunately, we couldn't get all votes for this piece. That said, we really enjoyed it and want to strongly encourage you to keep submitting. And then recommended a few
That's
other places. But
great.
That is the best. I mean...
That's so transparent.
The only communication that I've gotten that was, you know, emotionally satisfying on that level was the acceptance letter from Unbridled for The Evolution of Shadows. I mean, in 15 years, most all of my rejections have either been just kind of the form rejection. Sorry, but this isn't right for our list. What does that mean?
Even though it totally fucking is, because I made sure that it was before I sent it to you.
Or simply the no reply thing. Where
the ghosting. That's
right,
so frustrating.
Where they've simply put on their submission things. If you don't hear from us in 6 months, consider it a rejection.
It's like, I'm not going to wait for 6 months. I'm going to continue to submit. Like,
well,
what the fuck
everybody
about?
Takes simultaneous submissions now because of that.
Because of that, yeah.
But I also find it, I've also found it rather offensive because so many of, particularly agents, I find it particularly offensive from agents who demand so much professionalism from us when we submit, but they're letting themselves off the hook by saying, we'll just ignore you if we don't want to do anything with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. I can, and now mind you, having been an editor for my own journal, I kind of understand the, like, sometimes with some people, it's really best to just, you know, ignore. Because once you start, there was a guy in the early 2000s who made a whole fucking name for himself on the literary thing by fucking antagonizing agents after getting rejection letters.
Oh, jeez.
Right. And he would post the replies and all this other stuff like this on this website. I can't remember
That's
what it
creepy.
Was. But it was like,
you actually got a rejection letter? Great.
So, but because of, but I can actually, I can pretty much point to that guy as a reason that a lot of agents don't reply to everyone with a form rejection letter anymore, because it opens up this particularly online. Online has made it easier to submit. It's also made it easier to annoy and antagonize and make life miserable for people. So basically just say, you know, if you don't hear from us in 6 months, consider it a rejection.
Yeah.
And if the person writes back and politely asks, hey, I submitted a manuscript, can you tell me what the status is? They might go, yeah, it's been rejected. Because they do allow people to follow up just in case something was actually missed. But right, that also gives them an opportunity, you know, if somebody writes back and goes, I submitted something 6 months ago, what the fuck is going on? They block and ignore. And it keeps their shit clean. I understand that. Because the only people that respond that way are unpublished, unprofessional dick snobs. Right. But here I am. I've, as the old baseball saying goes, I've been to the fucking rodeo before.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, exactly. I know how to be a professional. At least give me, you can see it in my fucking cover letter, because you ask for a bio and it says right here, my first novel by Unbridled Books in 2009. When this was a notable book, it was a Indie Next pick, yada, yada, yada. I am a professional. This person dealt with me well. The book was well reviewed in Publishers Weekly. I know what the fuck I'm doing. At least give me the courtesy of a form rejection letter, because you know that I am professional enough to just take it and walk away.
Yeah.
Do that much. You demand this professionalism and three comp titles from my fucking ass out here in the middle of the boondocks? Give me the professional courtesy of a fucking form letter at least. Don't just ignore me.
Agree.
I've been to the show, you dumb.
I totally agree.
Shitbag. That's why I gave up on agents.
Yeah, I don't know what the best way is to do this. It's like, I mean, like this small press I'm talking about, like they're like, oh, well, this book is too long actually for us. We're doing like very short things right now. I'm like, oh, that's cool. He's like, but we'd be thrilled to read something else of yours. I was like, okay, well, here. So I sent him my pirates stuff. And they were like, cool, we'll get to it very soon. But then, you know, all this stuff. When it's a small, very small press like that, and something happens to the one person in charge, then yeah, I'm gonna have to wait for a bit. And that's okay. Like, I know he's going through all the shit, but yeah, I know. But then there's a thing, what's like, if I could have an agent, that would make everything a lot easier, right? But then to get an agent is like really hard. But that's what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about form and function.
So we're looking at three essays of yours.
Do you want to look at them as like a lump, or do you want to look at them separately, or how do you want to do that?
Well, I think we can look at them as a lump if you want to, because
cool.
I mean, there's, to me, having read them, because I did read them.
I would hope so. I hope you're not going to talk about them having not read them.
You know, after all of my time of complaining about how hard it is for me to finish reading shit, wanted you to know that I did actually read each and every one of the three essays that you sent to me to read.
So these are though short, because they are, even though Substack is not necessarily a blog, it's very bloggy to me. And so the shorter pieces, people do very different length stuff. Like they don't do like super long form stuff, like not full formal essays like you do for a journal, but people do between blog post length things and like normal non-formal essay type lengths. So
what really,
I think that's why we picked three of them, right?
Right. But what really is the difference in the form? Because this is something that I either don't pay attention to or don't understand when I write stuff like this. So, I mean,
the main difference I've found actually is a personal one. And that's that most people who are writing on Substack and using it are writers. Oh, okay. And so it seems like the followers that you get beyond, like, you know, your friends and family and stuff, the people that actually start to follow you are people who are involved in writing in some kind of way. or they're like academics, or they're, you know, they're for somehow they're involved in writing a lot more than just like Joe Blow blogger. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's kind of it. Like the and also it gets to everyone a lot differently. Like when I post to my blog, it just goes up to my blog. And hopefully if you're following it, then you see it or whatever. Or if you find it through hashtags or whatever. But nowadays that's a little bit different because there's no more Google Reader, and that doesn't really, people don't use RSS feeds nearly as much as they used to and all that kind of stuff. So when you post to a blog, you post to your website, basically. When you post to Substack, you post to your like blog, I'm doing air quotes around blog on Substack, but it also gets emailed to everyone who follows you. So everyone who subscribes to you gets an email in their inbox and they get your recent work. And then you can do things where, like, if you pay for a paid subscription, you can do extra stuff, like different things, or you can, you know, add extra things. Like there's different little formats. There's like a threads like thing. There's like a sort of, it's called notes. There's like a sort of Twitter conversation sort of area. There's like different areas. It's kind of social media, but it's also very writer centered. So that seems like the difference. And so I know who my audience is. And so that's why when I first started it back in December, I picked very specific older works that I thought that writers would enjoy, that writers or academics would like to read, would be interested in. And so I started with the ones that were the most finished that I thought that those types of readers would like.
Right.
And then I gathered a bunch more followers, and then I got some feedback from some of them, and they're like, oh, this one thing you brought up in this one article makes me interested in. I'm like, oh, so I'll write a new article about that. And so I'm starting to get feedback from people and to do fresh pieces based on like what they've actually said that they want to read. So it's almost like I have like a little tiny mini online magazine that I'm like very customizedly gearing towards my specific audience.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's kind of the technical function of the thing.
Yeah, well, it's what I think of when I think of like, who's my audience. Whenever I write for Substack, I'm like, I know who my audience is. That's something that, especially with nonfiction, like, I need to know exactly who my audience should be and like, who's going to want to pick it up or who would be interested if they haven't already followed me.
So how would you say that awareness of your audience? Because I think that awareness of the audience is more important to nonfiction than it is to fiction.
I would agree. Yeah.
Right. So how then does that awareness of the audience affect the way that you structure or plan the flow of the essay, the form of it, its arc? How does that?
Well, for these Popination essays in particular, I am doing it as an ongoing Monday morning series.
Right.
And Popination started off as a vocab word. Because I like to do a Friday vocab word of the week. And I came across that. I was like, I do that. So Popination is a 17th century term, I think.
Yep.
That means...
That's your Popination part one and part two that we looked at here.
Frequenting taverns. And so I'm like, oh, that'd be cool if I just did that and like wrote it. Because one of the essays that I liked to read most was Neil Gaiman's... what did he call it? It was like six, I think. And he like documented his time in the nightlife of London, starting at 6 p.m. and ending like in the morning. Or maybe it was 6 to 12. I don't remember. It was like all night. And he did this essay where it was very blocky, but he would like do these little like episodic little bits of like, here's what I did. Then I went here. Then I went here. Then I had coffee here. Then I met this person here. So he like had this kind of like chronicle of his night out in London for one night. I was like, that is so cool. I would love to do that. Everything in Boulder closes at 10. That doesn't really work. But so I was.
It didn't always used to close at 10, did it?
It was
just post pandemic.
Maybe midnight.
There were bars we stayed out till 2, weren't there?
Not very many. There was like Sundowner. Catacombs. I can't think of anywhere else I would stay up until 2. Everyone
Didn't
closed
Oasis
it, like,
stay
midnight.
Until 2?
Which one?
Oasis.
No. They were done at, like, food was done at 10. They were done at 12.
Oh, wow.
Boulder just shut down at midnight, basically.
Unless you went up on the hill, right?
Yeah, probably. That's probably more on the college area. But yeah, so I was like, oh, it'd be fun.
At 52, closing at midnight is fine with me. At 27, two, you better stay till 2 because I'm not done drinking till 2.
I know, right? No, I know. I have this show tomorrow, this burlesque show, and it starts at 8:15. Oh my God.
What?
I want to be in bed by then. Anyway, so the way of craft for me with this kind of thing is I notice that I get more attention when I put more of myself and my own personal stories into a thing. Uh-huh. And I actually got requested it'd be neat if when I did these first two, the Popination Part 1 and the Popination Part 2, the reason that it's in two parts is because I did a whole outline of what I wanted to talk about.
Right.
I wrote out the outline. So what I like to do when I write nonfiction is I like to outline it either with bullets or with the numbered kind of outline, either way, usually just bullets.
Do you find that that helps you kind of organize your
nonfiction?
Thoughts?
Yes. For nonfiction, for sure. Huh. Never for fiction. Fiction, that fucks me up.
Right. Right.
But for nonfiction, I like to outline it. It just helps me. And that way I just kind of add to it.
Right.
And then by the time I add to it enough and I'm like, oh, this part is interesting. I want to talk about that. And then by the time I'm about to draft it, I almost have it completely written. I just need to get rid of the bullets and then fill it in basically. Huh. So it really helps me with nonfiction in particular. It's never helped me with fiction though, or certainly not. Obviously poetry just comes out very organically, but no fiction. I need to start off with Once Upon a Time and just go and see what happens next.
Right.
But nonfiction normally is, I very much do an outline, but then I noticed that after Popination, this Popination outline, I was like, this sounds really interesting. And then I only got to half of it. I was like, this is already long. So I was like, oh, okay. So this needs to be two parts then. Okay, cool. No, that's fine. That's fine. I can divide it into two kind of time. I made it a chronological type of thing. So I'll keep the first half, the sort of older stuff. And the second half will be the sort of more recent stuff.
Right.
And then I got lots of feedback on both of those. And they're like, all of these are so interesting. And I kind of want more. And one commenter in particular was like, it'd be so cool if you just went to pubs and told us stories about your life.
Yes.
But then just also make it a pub review kind of. But what I'm noticing that most readers enjoy is hearing stories about my situation, my life, my thoughts, that kind of thing, which as a Gen X woman, I'm that I hate that. I have no idea why you say that. And everyone's like, your life is interesting, write about it. I'm like, really? Are you sure? They're like, yes. So ever since those first two were done, I started to do okay, I'll do one pub then per week. And the ones that I write more about the pub are way less engaged with than the ones that I write more about myself and maybe even don't even talk about the pub that I'm at. That's been really fascinating. And that actually dictates a lot of my form too. Cause I'm like, well, the function, obviously the function of these essays are like, hey, I want to talk to you about this cool place. And I'm basically writing personal essays or memoirs. I guess it's more like memoir cause it's more emotionally centered, but I always subtitle them. There's a series of unhinged personal essays disguised as pub reviews. So that's been dictating a lot of how my form has changed. They've become a lot more about the personal essay part of it. And it's just the setting, it becomes the whatever pub I happen to be at. So like, if you look at Pop Nation 1, Pop Nation 2, those are kind of summary. And then the Pop Nation, which one are we looked at the
Consternation, the one about Old Consternation, Chicago.
Old Chicago. That
which
one
I had no idea got
more.
Started in Boulder.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the flagship one.
I had no idea
there.
that Old Chicago that I'd sat at a couple times was the original. No clue.
Yeah. The OG.
Yeah.
And that one just ended up being way more about my past mm-hmm. and some stories about my life there. So,
right, but the pub and the Pop Nation part gave you the centering thing.
Well,
so that's also part
idea.
Of the form is that you got the centering piece, and then that allows you to fall out into your own.
Well, like there. So if you look at the Consternation one, Pop Nation Consternation, the Old Chicago story is three little stories, and then kind of a description of the place too. But like, there's three different personal stories involved in that one mm-hmm. personal essay, but I wouldn't have probably thought about those things had I not centered it on that actual place, because right. all those things happened at that place. So I feel like the form of it is still, it's interesting because it's like the pub is the setting. So like mm-hmm. I'm like picking the setting first, I guess. Although I guess I already have me as a character, right? If we're right. talking about like setting character, whatever, plot, time, all the crafty bits. But I start with the setting, and it's like centered on the setting, which is different for me. Because I usually, when I write fiction, I write like, here's what happened. Here's this character, and here's who they are, and here's what happens next, and here's what they choose to do, and here's what they want, and here's what they do to get what they want. Here's what stands in their way. Instead, like these essays are more centered on setting, but they're not, because all the stories that happen within them are just personal stories. So,
yeah, it's interesting because when I have, you know, I post on Medium when I do mm-hmm. sort of personal essay-ish type of things like that.
And your blog too, right?
Well, no, the blog right now, at least in the last 4 or 5 years, has basically just turned into a kind of like a landing page for the podcast and my mm-hmm. monthly reports.
Yeah, the monthly thing. Yeah.
What I'm working on, submitting, reading, listening to, whatever, which is just kind of a catalog, almost like a journal.
Yeah, it's like
right.
it's a personal essay, though,
so
kind of.
But it's more, not really, I don't really get into the personal essay thing until I get down into the thoughts section.
Yeah.
And sometimes
right,
that right. can be really disjointed, and it's not so much about trying to actually write an essay, but just kind of, and I find that actually there have been times where what I put in that thoughts section has inspired an essay, but in both cases, what it is for me is it's not sitting down like you do with an outline going, I want to talk about this. It's uh-huh. more kind of a, most of my essays have started off as shower thoughts, like where I'm standing there in the shower, whatever, and just this shit keeps running through my head, and it's all coming into me in fragments and pieces and whatever. And if I sat down and tried to outline it, it wouldn't go where I wanted it to go. It would go someplace that felt artificial to me. If that makes sense.
Well, I mean, I don't follow my outlines like religiously. My outlines tend to be more sort of like I don't know if you've ever done any like cluster or cloud mm-hmm, mm-hmm. brainstorming kind of thing.
Right.
They tend to be more like that. I'll like take whole sections out of it, or I'll cross them out, or I'll like be like, I'm not sure if I want to get rid of them, so I'll just do the like the strike through font, and I'll decide later. Like, it'll change a lot. Like, I'm not like super adherent to those.
It takes me so long to write an essay because I can't outline. That tends to like get me somewhere I don't want to go, or I'm not able to clearly see the thoughts enough. That makes sense. And I've tried the bubbling and the cloud thing, and it just gets way too confusing.
Well, that's why it helps me, because I do the bullets, and then I'll be like, okay, that's a basic idea. then I'll go back like later and I'll be like, okay, so this part actually belongs down here. This part, probably I need to do more. And then this one, I'm not sure. I'm going to maybe put that like on a separate page and make that like the cutting room floor. Like, but like, it just helps me to just get the idea out there. And then I'll fill it in. It's like I'm filling a blank or feeling like a form.
Yeah. What I tend to find when I sit down to try to write essays like this is that it sometimes takes me a while to find my thesis statement. And I'll sometimes write, you know, 400 or 500 words or more until I find my thesis statement. And then that's where that moves it up to the top. And then the rest of it is me trying. An outline doesn't help me organize my thoughts. No one ever trained me on that very well in high school or any of the things like this. I don't know how to use an outline very well. I don't know how to think about it very well. It just doesn't do anything for me. I have to.
Have you ever done reverse outlines before?
No, I don't even know what that is.
I do that with my students sometimes. Reverse outline is where you take an essay that you like or that you think is really good for whatever reason, and you create an outline from the already completed essay.
Interesting.
It's how I teach students to create outlines of their own.
I see.
Especially if they're like you and they're like, I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to do in the outline. Like, I don't know. So I'm like, so take an essay that you think is actually good and formulated well, and then make an outline from that. What do you think the outline would be for that? And it's really interesting because it just makes you go, oh, okay, I see how it's structured. It makes you just see how it's structured, basically.
Right.
So
maybe we offline sometime we can walk through that. But what I find also is that, you know, and then doing the cloud, you know, thought thing, just like us, it gets way too confusing because I end up going
too disorganized for me.
I end up going, well, this relates to that, and that relates to this, and it all relates to everything.
Right.
So what I find is that what I end up doing when I sit down to write a personal essay is I figure out what my basic thesis statement is. I try to get that as clear as possible. What is it that I want to talk about? What's the general gist of it? And then I just write, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I write. And what I'm looking for, what I find often with my first or rough drafts as I go through the process is that I'm constantly restating the same thing again and again and again and again.
Right.
Because what I'm looking for is that paragraph or that phrase or that way of knitting the thoughts together that is the most precise and most elegant. And once I get to that point, once I'm able to mush all that stuff together, that's my... You know, that's how I line up the paragraphs so that they connect to each other and show the thought process. But I can't seem to do that in an outline, and I can't do that with the cloud. I have to sit down with an essay and just basically think on paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to restate this again five times until I get it right. I'm going to restate the next part. That connects then to this, and I'm going to restate this next thing.
Yeah. Especially first drafts. That's a great way to do it. Especially if you have like what I used to call when I would teach like freshman comp, I call it what's my freaking point. Cause I'm like, if you're picking a topic that you want to write about, right? It's a nonfiction topic. You're picking a topic you want to write about. So the word thesis is like, so like no one knows what a fucking thesis is. I don't know what a fucking thesis is. Like, no, just what, what's your freaking point? And then tell me why I should care. Tell me why you like why this is important to you. Tell me who thinks it's bullshit and tell me why they're full of shit. Like, it's like, I put it very plainly. And that's when you're doing a first draft like that, you're like, oh, my freaking point is this. Or if you don't know what it is quite yet, but you're like, oh, I really like this topic. I want to write about it. I'm not sure exactly what my freaking point is. But you just like start doing that. And then if you find yourself repeating yourself, you're like, oh, I'm repeating myself. Oh, I see. That's what I'm repeating. Great. So that must be my thesis. Cool. Then I can like sort of like pare it down and like make it a little bit more coherent and stuff like that. These are not essays like that though. I don't have a thesis. they're not structured like that at all. These are all very, I mean, I call them unhinged because I just feel like they are.
Right.
But like, these are not structured like that whatsoever. So I don't know what to say about form, except that it's like a centered on setting kind of thing. I know I want to write a personal essay, and I know I was, okay. So an example is one that we're not talking about today, but it's going to be even though it's not one we're talking about today, it's going to be illustrative. The most recent one I did was called Papa Nation Integration. It came out on this Monday, which, okay, no one's going to know what that is when we publish this. But anyway, I went to a new brewery because I was going to go perform on Friday.
July 10th was when it came out.
It was when it came out on July 10th. Okay. So I went to a brewery because I was like, oh, it's a new brewery. I've never been there before. Cool. I'll try it out. I'll try out the beers. It was a boring, like, you know, it had nice art on the walls. It was fine. It had a sunny beer garden. It was fine. It was fine. The beer was fine. It wasn't delicious. It wasn't bad. It was like fine. And then I went to the show. I was like, this is going to be boring. I can't write an entire essay on this boring. I don't have any personal stories that happened there. It's a new place to me, right? Like that was the first time I'd ever been there. And I was like, oh, no. You know what I'll do? I'll just write the essay about the entire evening.
Right.
So I started out at the brewery, and then I talked about how the Uber driver was super worried to drop me off there because it was in a really weird place. And then I just talked about my entire evening with the performance, the other place I went to. So it was like barely about the brewery.
Right.
So like my point is like, these are not structured in any way that I have any idea what the, how to even talk about form, except that I know that they're centered on setting.
Right.
Kinda. But they are also personal essays, probably more memoir on the memoir side of the fence than the personal essay side of the fence. Also, that one of my favorite essayists that I love the most is named Clive James. Brilliant essayist, commentator.
Oh.
I have a copy of this is his Cultural Amnesia collection.
Right.
So you can flip through this book, and it's a doorstop, and it's fantastic. He'll have an essay called Jorge Luis Borges. You're like, oh, great. I'm going to read an essay about Jorge Luis Borges. And you might totally be reading an essay about the Korean War. I don't know. I can't speak to that particular essay, but right. You know what I mean? Like he goes off on these tangents, but then it's like somehow brilliant. Now, I'm not saying mine are, because I'm not nearly as good at writing this type of essay as Clive James is, but I'm aspiring to that, and I am inspired. I aspire to that, and I'm inspired by his work. Where you read an essay that's titled by the name of somebody, an artist or somebody he's supposed to be reviewing, and then he veers off into this incredible like discussion of history and then other cultural commentary. But it's like by the end, you're like exhilarated and you've been on an amazing journey.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe by the 100th one that I do like this, it'll be an amazing journey. I was thinking maybe you should give me plus our listeners some of your thoughts about these three essays and form and function, and then maybe we should conclude.
I guess sort of my broad thoughts on here is that I was kind of mostly curious as to what your thinking was around how you're structuring and putting these together. And you kind of answered that, right? You have your launching point. A lot of times
setting.
You know, nonfiction does start with a launching point, particularly with personal essays, right? Mm-hmm. More so than reportage and journalism and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Personal essays often start in an obscure place or with something and go wildly left of that launching space. So as you were talking earlier, was that I started thinking about Laird Hunt's recent book of essays, this wide terraqueous world. Have you had a chance to pick this up yet or read it?
I have not picked it up yet. No, I've seen it.
That kind of reminded me of this because there were a number of essays in this. These are essays in fiction. And so it kind of reminded me of that is that he would start in some interesting place and it would just go slightly different than where you thought it would go because this was, again, a personal essay about certain things. You know, and it would have its launching point.
Yeah, that's how Clive James is, yeah.
And so from a form and function, you know, that seems to make sense, right? You're doing something here. You're taking the reader when the goal is to take a reader on a journey through your what amounts to basically your personal headspace or personal experience, it seems that from what you're saying here, the way these essays read, you know, the references you've made with James, right?
Clive James.
Clive James. And with Laird Hunt's book here that I brought up, is that you are kind of, the form is that kind of stream of consciousness approach almost. But of course,
there is a few rings.
Because you are attempting to make art and to land at a certain spot, there's intention and that's going to affect the form. That's going to cause you to weed things out, to prune stuff away that is irrelevant, mm-hmm. even though it may have come to you in the moment.
Mm-hmm. How does this connect or not with Kerouac's work? I don't want to compare them. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying like he had sort of a lot more curated than the mythology likes to say, but.
I mean, you kind of get something similar to this if you go into like the Vanity of Deleuze, which is almost.
Oh, yeah.
With his basically a transcribing audio text with vanity, but not that. I mean, but when you get into the actual novels, the stuff like that, because he changes character names, because he does manipulate the story, I don't know that necessarily has a correlation to the personal essay because he is...
I don't know. Isn't it so like we kind of know who these people are in his story,
right? Well, you
kind
of do, but it's still that the story is... You know, this is the thing that we often... talked about in some of the fiction workshops with mm-hmm. some of the young writers that hadn't had a lot of experience taking personal story into fiction is that a lot of times those young fiction writers who are trying to create fiction out of personal stories, they try to hold too solid to the facts of the event.
Right.
Right. And so it loses that fictional thrust. Whereas a personal essay, you're not...
You might still have to change the names.
Have to change the names, but with a personal essay, you're not... Because you're not creating fiction, because you're not trying to tell a linear story with, you know, the Freytag's triangle bullshit and the whatever, you are, in a sense, with a personal essay... In the whirlpool, you're circling an idea and you land on an idea. Your goal with the personal essay and the form and the function of that is to express an idea, not to necessarily tell a linear point A to point B story.
Oh, you I don't can, know if I agree with that.
You can, but the point with the personal essay is more what's going on in your head and the story, fiction is more about what's going on in the world. It, right. You can travel through the world. You can travel through the world in a personal essay, but the point of the personal essay is here's how I interpret it. Here's how I connect it to all this stuff. You can do the same thing in fiction, but fiction has to have a thrust to it that a personal essay doesn't because the personal essay is internal monologue, internal dialogue. It's well, at least the way I think of it is you're attempting to, you're still kind of following the idea of a thesis statement, right?
That's interesting because like when I would go through my memoir project with Herb Childress, he actually brought up the Burroway textbook that I use for my DU classes a lot. He's like, look at this checkmark shape. It's not the Freytag pyramid. It's like, it's more of a checkmark kind of shape. It's the same. It's a similar idea. And he's like, look at that structure. And like, that should be the same sort of narrative that you're telling when you tell these stories. Because even though you're telling stories that are true, you are still telling stories, and it's still a narrative. So, I mean, I guess unless it's something more abstract, it's still telling a story. It's still telling this happened, then this happened, then this happened. This protagonist character wants this and goes for it I don't know.
I suppose you could say that the personal essay is the only spot in Western American literature where we are allowed to address plot on the same internal level that the Japanese do in their fiction.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
Because if you take a look at On the Road.
Yeah. Well, that was why I brought up Kerouac, because it's like, so how is that sort of stream of
consciousness?
Because
On the Road is, yes, it's stream of consciousness, it's fiction, but the whole thing is about, you make this trip across, you know, the country. He's having this coming of age type of narrative, and it's fictionalized. Yeah. The events that happened in On the Road aren't exactly a match to what happened in real life.
No, of course. But I don't know. I would aver that like any memoir or personal essay has some kind of like,
as spotty, you can't do it exactly. And as spotty and manipulative and falsifiable as human memory is.
Right. Exactly.
Right? Memoir.
You and I have talked about memory all the time.
Way
like
more
is
in
up.
Common with fiction than it does with journalism.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Which is
for
why
sure.
We have this whole category of creative nonfiction, and why you have these dumbasses that go, it's a nonfiction novel. What the fuck does that mean?
What does that mean? I don't understand that at all. But yes, no, I, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's, you made it up, but it's all true? What?
Like, what is it? Okay. What's a Bildungsroman? Like, come on. Like, it's... You fictionalize your life story, and that's okay.
Right,
like,
right.
That I can wrap my brain around.
Well, I guess the other way to think of it is that, you know, Kerouac took his real life and turned it into a novel and said, it's a novel. I made it up. Yeah, it's based on what I did in my real life. It's all made up. And then you have the personal essay, which is over here on the other side. And then you have the thing that kind of draws the bright line between the two of them. That's James Frey's A Million Little Pieces, where he wrote it as the novel. And then because he couldn't sell it as a novel because it was shit, he said, you know, it's a memoir. Right?
Ugh.
And that's the difference.
Betrayed Oprah. He's an Oprah betrayer.
That's also the other difference, right? Is that the personal essay is, it, there may be some fictional elements or whatever going on to it, but the point is to convey your thought process on getting to a thing.
Yeah, I like that. I like that.
And fiction is more about getting to a broader, more...
It's more about ideology.
Right. A personal essay is going to be about personal truth that might have a universal component, right? But it's going to be based on your thought processes around the world, your philosophy, your ideology, or whatever. Fiction, if it's getting at truth, is getting at a more broad universal truth, the metaphorical aspect of truth.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah,
where you have the split, where you have that metaphorical split between vehicle and tenor. Whereas a personal essay is getting rid of the vehicle. In a personal essay is the personal essay. The whole context of the content of the essay is the tenor. Whereas you get into fiction, they're on more equal footing, tenor and vehicle.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does.
Because I'm just basically thinking on my ass here with a few beers in me.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I don't know that I would differentiate the two types of narrative as much, but I totally can see that. And you, like, you're pointing out that a personal essay is much more about the thought process of the subject, right, which is the author. That makes a lot of sense to me, actually.
Yeah, because if you make an intuitive leap in a personal essay, you're going to talk about it being an intuitive leap.
Yes.
In fiction, if a character makes an intuitive leap, you're really not going to spend a lot of time on that. It's just going to happen.
Right. No, exactly. Exactly. There's a lot more reflection and sort of, yeah, and commentary on
it. You have that swirling eddy aspect to the personal essay that you really don't want to have in fiction, because then everybody gets bored and puts it down and stops reading, no matter how wise you are.
Unless it's Japanese.
Well, the Japanese also have a very good... Well, a lot of times when you find that stuff going on in Japanese fiction, they keep it short.
Okay.
Right?
So you don't have time to be bored.
Right. So you realize that, yeah, I'm starting to get bored. Oh, but there's only 10 pages left.
It's done.
I'm done.
It's over. Arigato gozaimashita.
But also that's a totally Japanese thing to be really short and profound.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know?
The makers of the koan.
Exactly.
That's true.
That's why we have haiku and things like haibun, which I love the haibun.
And koans. And, yeah, exactly.
For a while, I was thinking about a whole project of haibun after Keith Abbott introduced me to the concept. And I still might do it because I still have a bunch of the fragments left around, but it was going to be called haibun for the missing.
Oh, wow, cool.
And what I was going to do was I was going to just collect a bunch of, you know, just do a bunch of research on, you know, lost and missing person stories. So you're like the various explorers that were trying to find the Northwest Passage, you know, around whatever, and write little haibun about, you know, the brothers that lost, you know, the one brother that got lost trying to find the Northwest Passage and the other one that got lost trying to find his brother, you know. I can't remember who the fuck those were.
Trying to look at the Titanic.
You know, or like Lou Welch, who like just walked off into the Sierras and they've never found his body.
Oh, yep.
And then there was that one essayist that we read, or maybe you didn't read him, but I read him at Naropa. This nature writer, he left behind journals, and then he would like, he was walking through like the Mojave and stuff like this, and he's just vanished. Yeah, so there's, or D.B. Cooper, right? Write a haibun about D.B. Cooper. I just wanted to have this whole collection, you know, of haibun about missing persons.
Oh, this is like a fun project.
But it's never gone anywhere, but who knows?
This should be another new project.
Maybe if I become weirdly independent somehow.
You're pretty independent now. More than me. That's a good conclusion.
Yeah, I think so. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Say goodbye, Jen.
Goodbye, Jen. The Outrider podcast is recorded by Jason Quinn Malott and Jen Zuko. Audio is cleaned up and refined by Heather Ann Eden. Our show is hosted by Podbean.com.